You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Tonight, of course, we will hear author Tim Wu, who is also a policy advocate and professor at Columbia University, best known for coining the term net neutrality. He served as senior advisor to the United States Federal Trade Commission, and in 2006 was recognized as one of 50 leaders in science and technology by Scientific American. He writes for Slate, where he won the Lowell Thomas Gold Medal for travel journalism. He's the author of Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, and Who Controls the Internet? Illusions of a Borderless World. We're also thrilled to welcome for the first time to the Aloud stage Madeline Brann, the host of KCRW's award-winning Press Play on 89.9 FM, our media partner. Madeline has been a journalist for 25 years, primarily in public radio. She worked at NPR for 13 years in Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, and she's received many, many awards for her hosting and reporting, and of course, her voice and her reporting as part of our daily lives here in Los Angeles, for which we're very grateful. After the program, after the conversation, we will take questions from you. We will circulate microphones as we do record for podcast. We'll try and to get to as many of you as we can, and please make your question a question. It's always helpful. And afterwards, Tim will be signing in the lobby, courtesy of our library store. So now, please turn your attention to Tim Wu and Madeline Brann. Thank you.
Everybody.
Hi, everyone. It's great to see you. Great to have your attention. I hope it's undivided for the next hour. Although maybe you've been trained by social media not to pay that much attention. But anyway, we're going to try to untrain you for the next hour or so. I just want to begin. I think a lot of you would like to talk a little bit about or hear a little bit about the election.
Wow. Okay. Right. We'll start right there. what think, was an election?
Something happened last Tuesday. Anyway, I think the president-elect, Donald Trump, you could call him sort of the attention merchant.
Yeah.
He was able to capture the electorate in a way that very few presidential candidates have in the way that he did it. And I'm sure you've been thinking about this for a long time, but what is your
More
take?
Lately, I'll admit.
Yeah. Yeah. What is your take on how he was able to do it in a way that is so unique and captures what you're talking about in this book?
Yeah, I think a lot of it. Well, let me start by thanking you all for coming and thanking the library for hosting this program. I began to launch the book at the New York Public Library, and I'm now beginning the West Coast tour at another great institution, so it's really an honor, and I want to thank you all for coming and to the library for hosting. So, you know, I wrote this book, parts of it during the early stages of the election campaign, and I've had a opportunity to sort of spend a long time thinking about the last 100 or 150 years of government propaganda, of commercial sales effort, and I think a lot and of the history of television, the internet, social media, reality television, and a lot of that does actually come together in this year 2016, which where you have what is really the first reality television president taking, believe it or not, taking a charge in Washington right now. I would say that some of you may have already read this book, but from having researched the book, you can see the techniques that were used by the Trump candidacy were classics in the genre of attention harvesting. So, in fact, I can describe three steps, which originate in the 19th century, were used throughout the 20th century, and used successfully here. Step number one is above all to get attention, to win the war for attention by all means necessary. So some candidates or some messengers make the mistake of sort of jumping to the message or to the issues. Trump realized, and many successful politicians realize, that first you have to win the battle for attention at all. And usually the best way of doing that is to be more outrageous, more outlandish, lurid, unusual, maybe have colors, whatever. And I think, especially in the Republican primary, Trump was very successful in making sure he was more in people's faces, had more of their attention than anyone else. He didn't get ignored. Often outside candidates who are not known don't get any attention at all. They don't get their message out. So he did that. The second thing, and this is really getting to the province of sales and marketing, is to understand very deeply what the, and again, deepest and most passionate emotions of your audience are, and to speak to those. This is something that patent medicine people did in the 19th century very effectively. Understand that people fear death, fear illness, and speak to some opportunity for deliverance.
But are these generally negative feelings,
they
negative
can
passions?
Be both.
Is it more effective to appeal to that than positive?
I think it just
feelings?
Matters that they're strong,
yeah.
Honestly. I think it just matters that the emotions be strong. Because other politicians have sort of played over the history. I mean, Trump is not the first successful politician, and I think have played to more positive. But the dark side is extremely effective. Fear, desires for things. And often, one very effective technique is to give voice to things that people are almost ashamed to admit to themselves, but to give voice to those kind of emotions. And when you do that, you really can capture an audience and hold them. And then the final thing that I think is really important is part of what makes it more like sales or marketing is to offer yourself as deliverance, to promise a solution to these problems. That's the sales part. Like, here is the answer. It's also a technique sometimes used by organized religion. Here are all these things that trouble you. Here is the answer. And I think if you look at the Trump campaign, it was very successful in, at least for half the country. Now, obviously, a lot of people didn't vote for Trump, but in offering a sense that I can help. And those are classic techniques. And so, there's a lot of ways of interpreting the election, but just from from my book, I think it is a application of classic sales and propaganda techniques that led to the victory. And I don't mean that completely pejoratively. I mean, most politicians, to some extent, use these kind of techniques. I just think they were used very effectively.
But do you think that this is something that he has studied, that he has maybe read a little bit of what's in your book, or not the whole book? But
she's making a very oblique reference to German propaganda techniques. But go ahead.
So, but did he study effective propagandists from years past and said, "I've got to do these three things," or is this something that he just knows innately?
I mean, there's a little bit of studying, but I think great salesmen are born, and some people just have that intuitive. Have you ever been sold something and you realize that? Some people are just very sensitive to what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. They can read your audience. And I think for Trump, I don't want to spend the whole time talking about the election, but I think he was very good at reading his audiences and from that developed a sense of what some of the voters who had traditionally voted for the Democratic Party wanted to hear. They wanted to hear that someone was going to reopen the coal mines, that someone was going to save Midwest, that someone was going to make America great again to people who felt that America had fallen. And I think, I don't know if you can teach that talent of seeing your audience and guessing what they want to hear. Most politicians have some ability to do it. I think he was good. And I think that partially explains why the success.
Okay, so let's go back in time,
sure.
Then, and talk about the original attention merchants. And I want you to describe a man named Clark Stanley.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Who was the first, and he literally was a snake oil salesman.
He was, that's true. better known as the Rattlesnake King. Was that what he liked to call himself? So one of the things I learned writing this book, I was very interested in the question, where did advertising come from? Was there always advertising? You know, it's sort of part of our life every day. We kind of amazingly probably see 1,000 advertisements, maybe more. Was it always thus? The answer is no. And advertising is an invention, I would say, about the last 150 years. And some of the real pioneers of the art of applied sales advertising were in the patent medicine business. And Clark Stanley was a one of these gentlemen. He looked like a cowboy. He had a goatee and wore a bandana and a big hat. He had supposedly grown up in Texas and lived with this Indian tribe for several years, who taught him the secrets of snake oil. No one knows if this stuff's true, but this is what he said. And he studied with the Indians. He came back with this magical formula. And to attract his audiences, he had a sort of a traveling show, but we know it was reported at the Chicago World's Fair. There he was. And he had a booth crawling with rattlesnakes. And people would come over to see what was going on, and he would kill a rattlesnake in front of people's eyes and then boil it and make the concoction into snake oil and sell it as a cure for various ailments. And it was wildly successful. And he used a lot of techniques I was talking about. So first of all, the rattlesnakes, his image, were evocative, got
people's
attention.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean,
sure.
You look at the guy, if you look at his advertisement, his old advertisement, very, very effective. And then he understood what people wanted. You know, a lot of people, pain, suffering. Medicine in those times was very uneven. And, you know, here was the answer, snake oil. Very successful. But the most important thing about the patent medicine salespeople, it wasn't that they were doctors, I think, but that they were the first advertisers. That the first advertising budgets were mainly about these miracle cures. And those techniques, as I discussed in the book, end up migrating to mainstream advertising, where almost everything is being sold as a miracle cure. In fact, when you think about many of the products you buy today, you might wonder how many of these are being sort of sold as cures or not. And that origin, I think, is really important.
Yeah, you think of something like Listerine, for example.
Yes,
has
right.
a very medicinal taste to it. So
yes.
It's supposed to cure you of your bad breath.
Right.
And it started out as a floor cleaner.
Yes, particularly. Also uses a battlefield disinfectant. So. But yes, Listerine was originally sort of brown liquid used for floor cleaning and disinfecting wounds. And it came under new management, as they say. And it's like, okay, how are we going to sell this stuff? Well, you know, the idea of selling this as a cure was really important. So what was the problem? Well, around the time they started selling Listerine, there was also this idea in the 1920s of selling to women as consumers. People sort of realized women buy things, they make their own decisions. We got to do something about it, so let's try and sell them stuff. So how are we going to sell Listerine to women? Well, someone came up with the idea that what women fear more than anything is to be unmarried. And so maybe the reason women are unmarried is because they have bad breath. And no one will tell you if you had bad breath. They invented the word heliotosis in the 1920s, coined the phrase. And so
advertisers made up that word.
Yeah, they made up. It may have existed, but they popularized the word. Uh-huh. Heliotosis. No one will tell you. And they invented this character, pathetic, what was her name? Poor little Edna. Poor little Edna, went the advertising copy, was often a bridesmaid, but never a bride. And she was reaching the tragic age of 30. No one was any more charming or beautiful than Edna, but for some reason, she remained unmarried. Little did she know, because her friends didn't tell her, that she had bad breath. Listerine, the solution. And even as I say this, I bet you're wondering, I wonder if I have bad breath. You know, do you ever hear this and start to wonder a little bit? Maybe I should use Listerine.
Or a Tic Tac.
Maybe that is the cure.
Someone
Tic Tac. You know, maybe I should be thinking about this. Toothpaste, sort of similar story, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, right. Well, I also thought what was really interesting is one of the pioneers in the selling to women products to make them more attractive marital prospects. One of the leading characters in this was a woman. Her name was Helen Lansdowne.
Yes, that's right.
She was a suffragette, so she saw herself as a feminist in those terms, and yet she was doing this.
There is this historical episode where the cause of women's rights, the suffragette movement, in the 1920s, becomes recruited to the actual people who are suffragettes, become recruited to work in advertising. And the messages of women's liberation become transmuted into the idea that women's liberation mainly means the freedom to buy things or to be free from various types of domestic labor. So, like, old maid cleaner is advertised as liberation from household drudgery. Or instant oatmeal is liberation from cooking your family dinner, you know, for the regular time. And there's the sort of culmination of this, maybe this is where you're going, is a successful campaign by cigarette manufacturers, particularly Lucky Strike, to associate smoking with the modern self-possessed woman, who has the freedom and the courage to smoke outdoors. In fact, it went so far that Lucky Strike staged a fake protest in the 1929 Easter Parade in New York City, where they hired women to smoke and say they were protesting for the right to smoke outside like men. But the underlying idea was that if you got women smoking, this was Lucky Strike's idea, you could double the market share of cigarettes, and it was successful. You know, continuing with the theme, the other is going to turn all about advertising to women. The book is not only all about advertising to women, but has parts in it. The other theme that Lucky Strike used, still one that you hear about today, is the idea that, directed to women, that smoking that cigarettes are a diet aid, so that smoking will, and that the slogan is, reach for a Lucky instead of a sweet. Mm. The advertising in those days was not subtle. In fact, you look at them, and there's pictures. So there's a sort of beautiful woman sitting there, and then sort of as a shadow is a much fatter version of her. And it says, "Is this you 5 years from now? Smoke, reach for a Lucky instead of a sweet."
Hmm.
Or
and you've
know,
come a long way, but
like,
you've come a long way, baby. That's not exactly
that's in the
subtle
that is in, that's in the 60s, which
modern.
Is another one. But just to add to that, advertising. Some of it's just like, "Are you going to get fat? Smoke Luckies." Like they're very, very. The 1920s advertising was not subtle, and they call it propaganda.
But when you think of the snake oil, similar things are happening today with juice bowls and whatever acai bowls and all that stuff. It's very similar, I find.
I think that we're human, and who among us does not want to live forever, stay young forever? These very basic human desires, I think, are universal. And so if 100 years ago it was snake oil or root swamp or the carbolic smoke ball that was going to do this, today it's like raspberry ketones or I don't even know all the things, acai, berry, or, you know, the lure of the magical ingredient that's kind of unexplained, mysterious, comes from somewhere strange, that has some ancient wisdom baked into it, maybe.
Anything with coconut oil?
Usually an exotic location. You know, people who work in, you know, shampoos will tell you, most of the shampoos are sort of similar, but, you know, these ingredients. I think we're also very vulnerable to that if you're a tech person. You know, what is the difference made by a gold-plated cable or, a XXX processor, you know, to your actual experience? There's like certain tech aspects, Nike Air shoes. There's always this sort of mysterious special sauce that is going to... Anyway, that's an old standby.
Yeah.
And so I guess one of the themes of this book is that a lot of the old techniques are still effective today. And, you know, why not? We haven't really changed that much.
But we think we've become a lot more sophisticated in decoding advertising messages, or at least aware that they are trying to target us and trying to capture our attention. And so are we more sophisticated, or are we just equally naive?
I think that every generation thinks that it's more sophisticated about things, but then when you look later on 20 years, they're like, how did they fall for that? You know, I mean, don't you even look back like 30 years ago and look at, you know, I'm sure people here thought, we'd figured everything out. It was the 1990s or 1980s. But, you know, people were lying in tanning salons saying, this is going to make me healthy. You know, processed foods, and I grew up eating all these processed foods and microwaving processed foods. Oh, this is better than cooking in the oven. You know, and I don't know what it is now that we're going to look back and be like, whoa, we were crazy. But I really do believe that we sort of, every generation has a kind of amazing ability to be blind to some of the most obvious things. You know, like 150 years ago, people were like, well, you know, you buy and sell people. That seems perfectly fine. I mean, I don't personally approve of it. If they want to do it in the South, go ahead. I don't know what will be that like 100 years from now, but it's going to be something.
But given the fact that you have steeped yourself in this,
yes,
and you have thought a lot about this, probably
right,
more than most of us, are there things right now that you look at as the snake oil of the 21st century?
Didn't we start by talking about the campaign?
Yeah.
let me think in particular. It's hard because some of these things will seem... I think it's a hard question to think what we'll look back at and think like, wow, we were really kidding ourselves.
Wait, I'll give you a moment.
Yeah, and no, maybe I'll get back to it.
Okay, back to it.
And that requires an amazing level of self-awareness, to be completely aware of what you think you're fooling yourself with. Although I'll note something. Jacques Ellul, the famous French theorist who wrote books on propaganda, one thing that really stuck with me that he said, it was like, you know, sometimes the easiest groups to propagandize to are the highly educated news-consuming public, because they are so sure they're immune to propaganda, they're so sure that they arrive at their own opinions, that they don't realize they're being, you know, sold to.
Hmm.
And it can happen to any of us. He said the only groups who are truly immune to propaganda are like farmers who never see a newspaper, or people living in very remote regions. Anyway, I just always think that's interesting. And the capacity for self-delusion is pretty powerful.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to go back to the past.
Sure.
And talk about the first propagandist in terms of the government.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a British gent.
Yes.
Who actually came up with the idea to staff the British Army, because he had a very slim forces, needed to fight the Germans. And he came up with this brilliant propaganda campaign. And it was the first time that had ever happened?
I think first time systematically government entered into the realm of trying to advertise in totality to the citizens and persuade them of something. I mean, I think kings and rulers had spoken to the public before, maybe, you know, declare their own glory and things like that. But like a systematic mass propaganda campaign, outside of the church, by the way. The church has been at this much longer. Organized religion is the word propaganda is, I believe, an invention of the Jesuits, part of the Counter-Reformation, to try to speak the truth to the Protestant movement. So there's a long history religious efforts to persuade people of things. But government entering into the game, I think credit for that is the British. I don't think most of us associate Britain and propaganda, but really they are the origins of it. And the situation is as you described. So in 1914, August, the British government declared war on Germany. They had an army, about 100,000 soldiers, maybe a few hundred thousand more, most of them in India. The German Imperial Army was 4 million people strong and had just taken over Belgium and was battle-tested and hardened. So Lord Kitchener, appointed the Minister of Defense, had a very serious problem on his hands. British tradition ruled against conscription or the draft. So he needed an army, and so he turned to the first major propaganda campaign. Many people have seen the American We Need You for the Army with the pointing finger.
Uncle Sam.
Mm-hmm. The original is Lord Kitchener, the British version, We Need You for God, for King, for God, and for Country. And what was so impressive about the campaign is it understood and borrowed from the best advertising techniques. In fact, took them to a scale never realized. English government, British government, covered every possible surface with posters. They held rallies in major cities. They made sure this idea of joining the army was on everyone's mind. And it was an incredible success. When you consider that to join the British army at that point, it's probably 50-50 chance of being killed or dismembered, you know, or injured for your life. I mean, yeah. It was a terrible war. People were coming back, died, or you know, people were dying, and nonetheless, millions of British men signed up voluntarily for the war. And I think why that episode is so significant is it served as a proof of concept that advertising works. You can see at the end of the war, a lot of the skeptics say, oh, well, we saw, in fact, Edward Bernays, a famous figure who wrote the 1920s book Propaganda, said, we saw the success of propaganda, made it clear that what had worked in war could work in peace and be dedicated to the needs of business. And so you can see, coming right out of World War I propaganda, in Britain and the United States, the industrialization of advertising, the idea that really, if it's going to work, it has to work at a mass scale. And then, you know, in some ways, our present, which is advertising, is a constant part of our lives.
But when you think of your three points of, yeah. of a successful campaign, so uh-huh. he got your attention with the Uncle Sam mm-hmm. type character.
Right.
What was the insecurity that he was trading on?
I don't know if, when Kitchener, you mean?
Yeah.
That's a very good question.
What I was think the that need they, that
so
he was
if you
addressing?
Read the, if you read like a speech by Rudyard Kipling during that time, I think they spoke to something that's realistic fear of a domination by Germany. Do you want me to read? We were talking about doing some readings.
Yeah, read a little bit.
Yeah, maybe I'll read Rudyard Kipling's speech and see how you feel about it. you know, right now. This is Kipling who... actually, one thing the British government did that was so interesting, I didn't have a chance to put this in the book, but they recruited the best authors and playwrights to the propaganda effort secretly. And had them write. And Kipling was one of them. So here's Rudyard Kipling's. Have no illusions. We are dealing with a strong and magnificently equipped enemy whose avowed aim is our complete destruction. The violation of Belgium, the attack on France, and the defense against Russia are only steps by the way. The Germans' real objective, as she has always told us, is England and England's wealth, trade, and worldwide possessions. If you assume for an instant that the attack will be successful, England will be not reduced, as some people say, to the rank of a second-rate power, but we shall cease to exist as a nation. We shall become an outlying province of Germany, be administered with that severity German safety and interest require. If we are to win the right for ourselves and for freedom to exist on earth, every man must offer himself for that service and that sacrifice. Well, that's pretty strong stuff, especially if you're English.
Yeah, and so
you know,
he's...
fears of German domination. And I'll say, you know, I spent a lot of time reading German and British propaganda from World War I. One thing I will say, and it's universally recognized, the British were much better than the Germans. The Germans were a failure. This is something Hitler personally sought to rectify when he came to power. The British did an amazing job of portraying the Germans as brutal, disgusting, malignant force that was threatening to every possible freedom and way of life that they treasured. So the harnessing of fear is so powerful in those materials. And I was reading a lot of the British propaganda. It's absolutely gripping. You feel terrified as you read it. They had this one, part of this was manipulating the news as well. So there's a lot of reporting done by the British press, which somewhat quasi-fictional. Maybe it was justified, I don't know. But there's this you know, story, for example, of German soldiers, you know, walking around Belgium, and there's like a child is crying, and then for sport they just start bayoneting the children and moving, you know, tossing them around, and that's like what they seem to do for recreation.
Totally fake.
Whether it's, how are we going to know? I don't know. You know, there's no fact checkers. Anyway, they're just very compelling stories of fear of domination by the brutal Germans. And I think that, if we look at my stages that I introduced early, was what was so effective.
Yeah. Well, so that reminds me, not the spearing of the children, but that reminds me that we're currently in a debate over fake news, mm-hmm. and whether or not Facebook, which is the largest single source of news for most Americans, tipped the election because of seeding of fake news.
Yes.
And whether or not Facebook should take some responsibility for that and try to prevent that from happening in the future.
Yeah, I think we're at a time where a lot of people are starting to say, you know, there's something to be said for journalistic ethics. We sort of thought we could do without them. Maybe, like, everything would work out. You know, the problem with Facebook, and I think as the arbiter of news, is that it is not a news organization. Its only function is maximizing click-through whatever is trending is what will be promoted. And, you know, so it's an amoral operation. And I think we're, you know, starting to see the disadvantages of that approach. You see it throughout the history of journalism. When the only approach is maximizing viewership, you lose something. And I think that in a very crude way, is what happened with Facebook. And, you know, it's not all algorithmic, some of it is, but having no creed other than maximizing engagement. There's a quote, I think, from a story, ironically, by BuzzFeed, where they said, you know, bullshit is awfully engaging. Early on in the book, there's a story of just fake news on a different level, where some of the early penny press papers are in a really intense competition to who's going to, you know, rule tabloid journalism in 1830s. And the New York Sun pulls it off with a story, exclusive 6-part series, of what is on the moon. Discoveries of, you know, the reports from the world's largest telescope, never redacted. And what they discover is trees, forests, cliffs, and so on. But the most exciting thing they find, well, first they find unicorns. If you ever wonder where unicorns were, they're actually on the moon. But what seemed to drive people, what attracted the audience most was the discovery of the man bat living on the moon. A creature not unlike ourselves, maybe of equal intelligence, but of different sexual appetites. So like the moon, according to the newspaper, was full of like fornicating man bats. Sold papers.
It really captures your imagination.
It does.
Number one on your list there. So I was also fascinated, speaking of news, to read in your book that news came about, or serious news, from in the middle of the century, a little earlier, through on CBS, because William Paley, basically wanted to use this to stave off regulation so he could sell more advertisements for his entertainment programming. So,
it's an uncharitable reading. But
well, it's in your book. So, that's my interpretation.
So, William Paley is one of the central figures of the 20th century. He's the founder of CBS. CBS, you know, now you think of CBS, you're like, oh, what the. But, you know, in the mid-20th century, I mean, it just seems like another media company, but in the 20th century, CBS was a network that could, you know, reliably attract 60, 70 million people every single night of every day. They had the best news. They had, you know, Walter Cronkite. They had I Love Lucy, Ed Sullivan. So, you know, their role in establishing prime time, which is a very important part of this history, and in, you know, establishing what the media is really significant. And Paley himself is this tortured, fascinating character. He's like a lot of the characters in the book have this aspect. Is sometimes they have higher aspirations for their mediums. They want to do something. I think they want to do something good, but then the pressure of the business model to reap the largest audiences possible is incredibly constraining to what they do. Anyone who worked in journalism knows this feeling, mm-hmm. where you suddenly feel almost the gravitational power of, let's say, running a story about a celebrity as opposed to about some interesting public policy problem or, you know, just juicing it up. And so Paley, the episode you're referring to is the early CBS, when it was just a radio network, was seeking to differentiate itself from some NBC. And one of the ideas was to have a good news operation and try to market CBS as a slightly more up, high, not exactly highbrow, but respectable medium as compared to NBC, kind of a differentiation. And I also think, I think I do say in the book, it also was, I think, effective. There was a lot of call for regulation of radio. A lot of people were saying, how exactly did radio become privatized? It was supposed to be this public mm-hmm. good, you know, sort of more like libraries, and it's become this commercial entity. And becoming a news outlet, I think, made Congress and Washington sort of afraid of CBS because they could then have the power to report on them. But the my bottom line is that Paley was this tortured figure, I think, in some ways wanted radio and television to be the best it could be, but ultimately became a prisoner of his own creation. And, you know, he was the one who himself, many of you may know Ed Morrow's show, See It Now, the most sort of mm-hmm. famous show that brought down the McCarthy era. Well, he canceled it and replaced it with a show called How Well Do You Know Your Wife or something like that, some ridiculous game show. What's the name of the show? Oh, I forgot. It's in the book anyway. You know, so he was both the architect of what TV and radio could be and its destructor as well.
But this was a time where Americans' attentions were not divided.
Yeah, that's right.
We were able, in the 1950s, I guess it's the right. height of yeah. conformist yes. culture in America. Uh-huh. Was that created by television, that conformist culture?
You know, I think there's a feedback loop. But I don't think it's any coincidence that the rise of a mass media and a rise of something very particular in human history, which is an entire nation sitting down and watching the same stuff at the same time, you know, at certain times of the week, that was really unusual. The only possible analog is in some religious practice, like, you know, on Sundays people go to church. The totalitarian countries in the 30s, particularly Nazi Germany, had used the radio to craft a single Volk, like a single people out of the German peoples. This was the Goebbels' idea, is we wanted to create a society which transcends the individual. And of course, that also meant getting rid of Jews and gypsies and other groups, but creating this like extremely organized country. And they realized the best way to do that was to have people listen to the same radio shows every day, and most of all, have everyone listen to the leader, Hitler, at the right hours. So the Nazis had their own prime time. It was a little more intense than Western version, because if you didn't sit and listen, you could be put in jail at certain periods. It became enforced listening for the leader's speeches. And they had a government bureaucracy called the radio wardens, who went out and herded people into rooms for the listening, for the hours of the nation to listen to. So in the United States, you know, I don't want to compare German radio with American things, but we also had this effect in the 50s of everyone listening to the same stuff kind of at the same time, and I think it naturally did create a more unified, conformist, you can choose your word, society. And I think there are good and bad things about it. Obviously, Germany represents some of the very negative aspects of it. You know, maybe there's some good parts also about being a unified country. Mm-hmm. But that was a very different time, attentionally speaking, than today, where we're, you know, essentially all watching our own little stream of information completely indifferent to what anyone else is watching. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know if either is perfect.
Right. I mean, you could argue, so you had the three networks and the three white men giving the news every night.
Right.
And it was pretty much the same news, and it had the same perspective.
Right.
And maybe that created a consensus or a feeling that we were all part of the same country. But also it excluded a lot of people.
That's right.
And it excluded a lot of points of view.
That's right.
Points of view that we get times a million now on the internet.
Hence, in the 60s, one of, and just, you know, a big part, one of the important parts of this book is the rise of counterculture, which in the 60s begins as a attentional revolt. You know, I spent a lot of time reading Marchese and Timothy Leary. It's a little, some of it is a little wild and strange, but essentially Leary had the idea that the revolution to succeed had to be an attentional revolution. It had to be what you spend your time with. And if you spend your time with television and commercial sources of information, you'll become programmed one way. And that what people needed to do was spend more time with each other or listening to music or taking LSD. And that would... Actually, Leary is more spiritual than people realize. He was like, people need to stop spending attention to commerce and pay attention to the spirit. And be on an inward path. So I think that episode is very important to understand our current times.
So what was his phrase? Tune in, turn on, drop out, something like that?
That's it, exactly. Yeah. Which was developed in conjunction, I think I got this from Boing Boing, actually, originally. A little shout out to Cory Doctorow, who's here, that... Marshall McLuhan and Timothy Leary met, and Marshall McLuhan said, well, you've got all these great ideas, but what you really need, actually, going back to our three steps, you need to get people's attention. You need something to reach them. You need an advertising jingle. You're not going to get anywhere unless you got something that people can relate to, a slogan of some kind. And Marshall McLuhan composed one on the spot, which was for LSD, 40 million... neurons, that's a lot. Oh, I got it wrong exactly. LSD hits the spot, 40 million neurons, that's a lot. That was his slogan, which was based on a Pepsi slogan, by the way. So he had his own slogan, and it's part of what we're...
Which was then co-opted by, I think...
Yeah, well, this is what
Sprite
I think is one of the...
Something like that?
Yeah, so, the... There's a constant theme in this book, which we haven't yet introduced, of resistance and revolution against advertising excesses. So advertising by its nature is harvesting of us as a resource. And sometimes it goes too far. Too much information is taken, or it's just too intrusive. You've probably had, surely everyone in this audience at least once has said, like, I've had it, and maybe they've installed an ad blocker, or maybe they've turned off. In the back of a taxi cab in New York, there's these ads that run at you. So people reach their breaking point. And in the book, they reach it in Paris in the turn of the century with the revolt against the poster. In the 30s, in the Depression, there's a consumer movement born. In the 60s, the counterculture is the revolt. But the advertising industry, the remote control, I forgot about that. I can talk about that later. But the advertising industry is very clever in the 1960s when they start to realize that the desire of the counterculture, the anti-capitalist ethos, can itself be sold to. That what was uncorked was maybe even more powerfully a desire for self-expression, a desire to be anti-commercial. And as I said, that anywhere there's desire, this starts to sound a little Buddhist, anywhere there's desire, that can be sold to somehow, that can be catered to. And so many people in this audience may remember Charlie Brown Christmas Story, a beautiful little TV special about...
Sad.
Very sad.
Depressing, sad tree. Yeah.
But fundamentally about the over-commercialization of Christmas, but also a branding triumph for Coca-Cola, who was the sponsor of it at the time, and they didn't think it was going to succeed. The most famous, if anyone has seen the series Mad Men, Mad Men is essentially about the co-option of the counterculture over the 1960s. And I think the ultimate expression of it is the Coca-Cola, the famous Coca-Cola ad, 1972. I'd like to buy the world a Coke. Very beautiful. I watched it again recently, and I find it incredibly moving. It's the expression of all of the most beautiful desires of the counterculture. There's people from all nations and all ethnicities together, singing, a sense of belonging, very beautiful heart-won emotions, harnessed very successfully by Coca-Cola, which is attempting to transition from being the stodgy 50s, vaguely Aryan, belonging cola to also being the countercultural cola as well. And that is kind of like the ultimate expression of it. And since then, advertising has been better at kind of co-opting the revolutions against it.
It's so good at that. It even co-opts our cynicism about them. And because I think the generation that followed the 60s generation was
right.
Saw itself as a lot more cynical about advertising
right.
And manipulation
right.
And reacted in a couple of ways, one being to check out,
right.
But another to just deeply suspicious about all sorts of corporate messaging and political
right.
messaging.
Right.
So I guess I'm wondering what this did to us in terms
right.
of our connection to the greater good and our ability to believe in things without them being ruined.
Wow. That is so many levels of cynicism. I don't... Cynicism about
well, I
cynicism.
I am that generation.
Cynicism
so.
of about cynicism. Well, I'll just say one thing. I've sort of played between the idea that we always get fooled again and that we don't. There is, an evolution of something in the 40s they called the propaganda reflex, which is a recognition that you're, being misled. But I come back to the idea that we shouldn't, overrate cynicism, that that itself can be played to. I don't know where that leaves you. I can tell you where it leads to. I think my own personal view on things is that you can't, you shouldn't overestimate your own brain or your own abilities, but it's at least have parts of your life that are disconnected. I'm more in that school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
that leads us to the modern age. And
right, sure.
And you save a lot of your vitriol for the modern attention merchants. You're really harsh about a lot of them. And what they're doing to us in terms of colonizing
right.
every last bit of our waking moments.
Right. Uh-huh.
Where did that first happen? Where do you pin the blame?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think, it has to be said, there was a moment in the early 2000s when, and I don't completely blame them, but when Google turned to advertising and proved that advertising could, in some sense, be a deliverance from all that had ailed the web, while it seemed like a great idea at the time, and I can understand why the decision was made, it led in directions that ultimately I don't think were the best. Larry Page and Sergey Brin had always hated advertising. They had, in their most famous paper, which described the Google algorithm, had said that any search engine reliant on advertising would be irredeemably corrupted and would serve advertisers instead of users, and that it was extremely dangerous. Now, then they started running a company, and at some point they needed revenue and turned to the advertising model. And I think this is where the danger was, is I think that it's one. I'm not against advertising. I think that a lot of important institutions are supported by advertising, including the print media is a good example. Some television. It's not like it's an inherently evil business model, although my book does make it seem that way sometimes. But to sort of assume that you had solved the problem of revenue, or you had solved, how should I put this, to be sort of blithely unaware of the dangers of advertising over the long term, I think was the fault of Silicon Valley. That once they put themselves in a place where they were completely dependent on advertising revenue, and then also public corporations that needed to increase their profits at regular rates, you know, put themselves in a very tough situation for the web. And that's the more successful companies like Google and then their imitators like Facebook. It's even tougher for the web publishers, who increasingly were pushed over the last 15 years to even more, for want of a better word, clickbaity, lurid content, you know, regardless of quality. And I think it ultimately led the web away from what it had been at its best into something much less than we could have hoped for. So that's sort of long story short. But I think it does come, as I guess, if I'm going to lay blame, it's with not being serious enough about the cost of an advertising model and pretending it was just free. You know, I think in Google there's a spirit in the early 2000s, we can have it all. We have the Diet Coke solution. You know, all of the flavor, none of the calories. We're going to have all this free stuff for everyone. We're going to make money forever, and it's never going to come at any cost because nobody minds the advertising. In fact, they're going to love the advertising. And everyone jumped on that bandwagon. And now we have these very powerful institutions whose continued existence depends on milking more and more of our time and attention and getting into more and more sanctuaries and places that were not previously contested, and also taking more and more personal and private information. And it's sort of set into motion, and that's where these businesses are. And I think maybe that could have been realized a little bit earlier. Few businesses that didn't do this, like, you know, for example, Wikipedia went for a nonprofit model, and I think is, you know, more sustainable. But these other businesses will, you know, are in this kind of trap.
Right, because at this point, Google is a public good. I mean, it's like a road or a highway that you have to have it.
Yeah.
And yet, it's a private company that's also trading on your attention.
Yeah, and it's painful because I spent some time at Google, and also I think a lot of the engineers there were truly idealistic people who wanted to do good. I know some people are cynical about that view, but I think there was not enough conscious thought about the dangers this was going. Now, AOL, coming like AOL in the other direction, was just, you know, from the beginning, trying to defraud people with advertising. So they're another story, but anyway.
Right, yeah. And they were the ones who first understood the addictive property of email, you want to click.
In fact, the first email, I found the first email addict. He was I forget his name right now, but he was the head of DARPA in 1974. DARPA was the, or ARPA it was called then, the Pentagon Research Agency, and I forgot his name right now, but he, everywhere he went, he lugged with him this terminal, you know, from the, that you could plug a phone into, and he loved email, made everyone communicate, so he would lug this huge thing with him, and then he'd arrive somewhere, you know, plug the phone in, and then check his email. So he was the first to have this habit that we all have now, which is that sense of a need to periodically check in, you know, to update, to see what happened. I think if people, you know, from another generation were to look at us and say, well, what is different about them and us, would be like, why are they always, like, grabbing, going like this? Like, they sort of have this reflex. And I think it was somewhere born in the 1970s.
So we were talking about there, it comes in waves. So there's a big push by advertisers to get into our private lives in some way and sell us stuff and harness our attention. And then there's the rebellion.
Yes.
And there are ways for where we say, okay, enough, we're not going to do this anymore. We have remote controls to zap out ads. We tune in, turn on, and drop out or whatever.
Right.
What are we doing now? What can we do now? Because it seems like the harvesting of our attention is done almost, well, it is. It's done without our direct knowledge because they are tracking everything we do online.
Yeah, I think that we are in the midst of a kind of a revolt. You know, I don't think it's consistent among everybody, but if you add up, you know, some of the cord cutting, some of the ad blocking, some of the success of subscription models like Netflix or HBO Go, a sort of sense of fleeing to quieter areas. You know, what can people do individually? So first of all, I think that there is some important social role played by that revolt, you know, that the one thing that gives me, you know, the optimistic side of this book is to say as people, when things go too far, people feel too invaded. They do react, and there's a long pedigree behind that, and, you know, the importance of that should not be understated. I think what you have to do is you, in our times where religion and tradition no longer set the rules, you sort of have to program your own life pretty intensively if you want to stay sane. I think you have to zone certain parts of your life as non-commercial. I mean, it doesn't seem like that crazy a thing, you know, to think maybe a day or two a week to be advertising free or, you know, family times or something. But I think you really have to make those choices, and they have to be made in a pretty hard way. Like, you can't be like, well, I'll, you know, you'd be on my computer and kind of talking with my family as well. It doesn't work well. If I speak personally, I've tried to do this, you know, by blocking out. I'm not the only one, but, you know, sort of block days where I don't use my computer if I can at all avoid it. I try to have certain times of my day only be family. I have two daughters, which are kind of a secret weapon because they're a feedback mechanism. And people who have children know this. Children are intolerant of attention. They're like attention meters. They can tell where adult attention is being directed. And if it's being directed, you know, not to them, don't like it. So I think that, you know, I keep family as a very important role. Eating. I try to think of eating as having its own. You know, I'm kind of like, as I get older and older, I'm more like an Orthodox Jew or something. You know, like I have these like these rules, but I think there's some wisdom in some of them, and almost you have to create your own rules to stay.
Well, there's a reason why religion is the original attention merchant.
They weren't commercial, but they definitely were the incumbent operation. Okay. I'll put it that way.
Well, yeah. I think we have time for some questions now.
Sure.
So, yes, in front here.
Oh.
Oh okay. Great.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak to the white feather aspect of the World War I.
Yeah, sure. I don't know if people know about this aspect of history. I think one of the things that made the World War I recruiting efforts so successful was the fact that the keeping of recruitment top of mind for British men was assisted not only by government but also by private groups who sought to shame men who didn't join the army. And if I recall correctly, they would put white feathers on them in public. And so there was a built-in addition to the government's effort, which was social, to shame people. And it goes back to the point that the battle for attention is often, you know, primary. We like to ignore things. If you get back in front of people, if you have your message always being presented, it forces the decision. British men were forced to decide, am I going to join the army or not? And most people would prefer, you know, kind of ignore that, put it off for a while, but they couldn't. And no matter what endeavor of life you're talking about, whoever gets their issue thought about has an advantage, no matter what it is. Right, like that prior battle for attention, no matter what it is. Anyone who's in politics or policy knows this. You know, if you have people talking about, let's say, race relations, it'll get more attention. If no one's talking about it, nothing happens. And so the White Feather campaign was one example of how the recruitment question was kept alive.
Hi, thank you. I'm going to bring it back to the election. I apologize. Sure. I was wondering if you could speak to the kind of irony of the like two opposing narratives of the Trump campaign, of it being like the base in these communities that were kind of left behind by the information economy, but then they were also galvanized by using the information economy, and also like if this is just another iteration of like master's tools can't dismantle the master's house, or if this is like different because of the way it has pervaded all of our attention.
Now, consistency. I say consistency is a hobgoblin of little minds. I think that there's no real contradiction between both the effective use of a more manipulable information platform, namely the web, Facebook, and other kind of messaging, and the deliverance of a message that didn't quite blame information technology, but that sought to deliver the message that there's something wrong with America. It's not your fault. It's these other people's faults, and I can solve your problem. And that it happened to be the best message, the best medium, because there's less fact-checking, is not inconsistent with that message being delivered. And ultimately, I don't know if this is giving credit, but why I think Trump was so effective is he promised to a lot of people an answer. And I mean, I almost feel like it's giving it, it was like snake oil in that sense. Like, you have this problem, here is the answer. And politicians who do that tend to be more successful. Whether they deliver or not is an entirely different story. But I think you can, hopefully if I understand these techniques from, maybe I'll all run from. I mean, the one thing that's a struggle for me with this, personally, I ran for office at one point, and when you face audiences, there is always a question of how much do you tell your audiences what they want to hear, right? Because you can kind of tell what people want to hear. If you are at least a sort of subtle, and if you have no qualms about saying anything, it's even easier. You know what I mean? Like, if you don't really hold. So a lot of people, they resist. They know what they want to hear, but they don't want to say it because it's inappropriate or it's just a dark art. Mm. But when I was campaigning, the temptation just to tell people exactly what they want to hear is very, very strong. And I think it takes some very powerful self-control and ethics not to do that, and it will put you at a disadvantage, which is kind of one of the paradoxes of democracy. So if someone can be both virtuous and also popular, that's a very challenging balance. Because it is, I say it again, you can just sort of see, and the less you care about the stuff, the easier it is to do it. You know what I mean? If you don't really, I don't know how, I have no idea, I don't know Trump well, but I do know he was sort of willing to say anything. And I think that was really useful. I don't know if he thinks that, Mexicans are rapists, but I think he thought his audience wanted to hear that, and so he gave them that. Maybe he did. I have no idea what he really thought. But he certainly knew what to give people.
But sometimes it's selling them something they don't know that they want.
Oh, like, that's a very powerful thing.
You look at Steve Jobs and what he did with the iPhone. He created a demand, a need, where one didn't exist before.
Yeah. Well, if we stay away from product marketing, but even just towards rhetoric, I think the detection of unconscious, one of the most powerful things you can do is detect what someone wants at some level but doesn't even admit to themselves. I think that's a very powerful skill. A good salesperson can do that. But I think it's a dark art.
I wanted to ask, at one point you touched on what would be the natural end of this kind of marketing glut and just the cycle and where we're going. I would say the natural end would be, if you look at it right now, we're almost there because almost everybody is a marketer themselves,
right?
Be it a YouTube channel, whatever your platform is. So just based on the principles that you've outlined, I don't really know what would happen after that, because then who would be buying? So there will be no consensus. Everybody's going to be just selling themselves. And then also, as far as news,
I think that, and this still, sorry, again, goes back to the election, I think that news is almost unimportant to people, and truth is almost unimportant to people, and that's very frightening, but it's very true. And you touched on reality television. Well, Donald Trump would be almost the president that I would say kind of the collective mindset created, because people do want somebody who is fearless, who I know I did not vote for him, but do want somebody who's fearless, who is not afraid to say anything. And it tapped into, I think, something within them, maybe their subconscious, that they aren't able to access. And he accessed it almost like a lock and a key.
Right.
So yeah, I guess if you could just speak to some of that and where you think we're going kind of with this mindset.
Well, there's a lot there. In some ways, I have... let me pick up on one or two of the things you've mentioned. I think our a lot of how we've been led to where we are comes from the desire and the colonization of everything by entertainment, and our incredible fear of being bored or reading things that are even remotely sort of challenging. And I actually can't remember the last time I was bored, because it's almost impossible to be bored. It's our environment is so stimulating. I think when Pascal said that many of humanity's problems come from the inability to sit by yourself in a room, I think there's some truth to that. And our constant desire to turn everything into entertainment, including ourselves, as a sort of forms of entertainment for each other, can lead in some pernicious directions. So, you know, you sort of talk about how everyone is their own source of content. And, you know, there's a very beautiful side to that, which I have a lot of admiration for. I think self-expression is obviously a wonderful thing, and I want to live in a country where people do express themselves. That very beautiful thing, I think, has over time, even over the last 10 years, become, you know, the idea that everyone is in some ways a micro or nano celebrity, and that you're going to, you know, get this many hits and become kind of able to sell stuff. And that is, I think, something that is very close to everyone being being self-expressive, but has a much darker side to it. I think many of us are beginning to suffer the kind of problems that celebrities used to suffer from. You know, they're constantly concerned about how they look in public, you know, what their public reputation is, or how many hits you have on your YouTube or Instagram account. And, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit of a downer, but I don't think that necessarily leads in the best directions. How's that? Yeah. Oh, there's Bonnie.
First, let me recommend a documentary called The Brainwashing of My Dad. It's all about advertising and the political system. But my question to you is about, there's a fraught history between government regulation and I would call television advertising.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's prescription drugs or advertising to kids, mm-hmm, or smoking. How would you assess government's role in regulating advertising, and what do you think it should be in this new internet age?
Well, that's a very big question. So the origins of government regulation of advertising are in snake oil,
mm-hmm,
as in the American approach to advertising has been, it's illegal to lie to people, but otherwise anything goes, basically. But you shouldn't lie to people. So snake oil is like, well, snake oil doesn't do what it's supposed to do, the elixir of immortality. So you can't have that, but almost anything else goes. There's been other approaches in the book. You can see in Paris, the French took a very different approach, which is they were concerned about the volume of advertisement and its effect on the consciousness, basically. And it's not particularly American, but sometimes I think it's too aggressive for what Americans would put up with. But sometimes I think, in particular, that this is what really bothers me, is when advertising violates the sense of a deal, that it's non-consensual. So let's say you want to watch football, and you want to watch it live. And so you, on Sunday, tune in to CBS or something, and you watch the ads and you watch football. So there's sort of a deal. You can take it or leave it. I find it very disturbing when there's no deal. You get in, for example, you get in an airplane. See, this happened to me recently. Happens more. And suddenly there's ads coming at you in the airplane, and you're like, well, wait, I paid you, and now you're doing more ads. I mean, taxi cabs have this problem. You know, essentially unconsented to taking of your private information. I mean, we supposedly consent to it, but no one really consents to the degree they're being watched or spied upon. So those are things that bother me, and I'll give you a framework for thinking about it. Ultimately, attention is access to your mind. That's all it is. And I think when you're in a non-consensual situation, it is almost like a form of battery in the sense that you're non-consensually being forced to give access to your mind. It's unavoidable, especially some advertising. And so that's what I think should be regulated. I think there's a lot more work to be done in consumer protection, in protecting this valuable resource called our time and attention. And I can't announce the whole program right now, but I think it's something that consumer protection should care about a lot more. Maybe one or two more questions. Yeah.
Fascinating, Tim. Thank you. Very good work.
Sure.
Can you give us like your insight of the work of Adam Curtis? What kind of influence does he have? Do you know who he is?
I don't think this
British is filmmaker. A Century of Self? Okay.
Oh, yes, A Century of Self. Yes, I read sorry, thanks for the reference. So, just a commentary on that documentary.
His work, you know, have any influence other than the, you know, the comments on YouTube? And just as a second question, who would you say today is the modern equivalent of somebody like Edward Bernays?
That's an interesting question. Let me stick with the first question. So, The Century of Self is a very good documentary. I recommend it. The essential theory of that documentary was that Freudian ideas of desire and unconscious fears and needs was imported into American marketing by Edward Bernays, who plays a big role in this book as well, the supposed father of spin, who wrote the book Propaganda that I talked about. And since then, we've kind of been sold to in very Freudian ways. I think it's that book, that documentary and that idea, I think is somewhat important. I don't think it's exactly historically correct. It's a little exaggerated. I did research on the early thinking of American advertising, and they tended to favor a different school of thought psychologically, the behavioralists, who believed that humans were essentially like animals who responded to stimuli. The behavioralists, this is before before research protocols or limits, they performed their experiments on human infants, and they would try to condition them in various ways. There was this famous experiment, Little Albert, where there was this infant who was fond of a little white mouse. But then they began to, every time the mouse appeared, they would strike a metal bar behind the baby's head. And so eventually the baby began to fear the mouse. And then ultimately, anything that was white and furry, the baby would like react to with fear. And so this experiment was by a man who later became an advertising executive, was used to, I'm not kidding. He was recruited by J. Walter Thompson to essentially to perform the same experiments on the whole population. was used to prove the premise that, you know, all of our behavior is conditioned. So I think there is a strong association between, rather cruder psychology techniques. I think Freud actually had less influence than that documentary gives him credit for, and I think they were more addicted to these kind of very straightforward, presentation, conditioned stimuli, kind of Skinner-esque kind of theories. Is this how we get people? The mother was paid $1 for that particular experiment, in case you're wondering. For a little, she was a wet nurse. Anyway, Little Albert. It's in the book somewhere.
One more question.
Maybe from Court, yeah.
Thanks, Tim. I wanted to ask, it feels like you merged a couple of different phenomena over the course of the evening. One was the way Google advertised when it looked at what you were viewing and then when it switched to advertising based on what it thought it knew about you.
Right.
And the other is that news that became very clickbaity because it was trying to get your attention versus news that became very clickbaity because it was the Kingston Whig Standard or the Arizona Democrat, and it was just hyper-partisan, and it got more readers by being as partisan as possible. Can you try and, like, give us a framework like the last one you gave us that divides the motives of the attention merchant or the tactics?
That's a hard... Can you give the back? I think I need to ask you to clarify.
Sure.
I think it's a good question. I just need to. So you're saying I'm merging the.
So like
right.
when Google advertises to you because it knows that you're on a page about asbestos and it advertises to you about class action lawyers.
Right.
That's fundamentally different from Google knowing that at some point in your life you looked up class action lawyer asbestos and then putting asbestos and class action lawyer ads on every page you see through its ad networks.
Agreed.
And in the same way, when a news organ promotes clickbait because it is trying to just get more readers versus a news organ that has an ideological bent, right? Like you know, Goebbels didn't get a Deutschmark every time someone tuned into Hitler,
right?
He was playing for all the marbles, right? So is there a difference, you know, or is attention merchant is purely mercantile attention merchants different from ideological attention merchants?
Really,
or do tactics
question.
Matter?
Right. I think it's a really great question. So I'm going to give you an answer. It might not satisfy you, which is that there's both in the book. I think this book is particularly about the rise, and the American model in particular is about a certain amoral kind of attention merchant. Speaking with your second example, whose interest is merely the maximization of advertising revenue, and so maximum audiences. So that's I Love Lucy, that's BuzzFeed, that's the New York Sun, and where behind it is a figure that really doesn't care, whose deepest interest is ultimately business. It's the, in some sense, what this book you could be said about is the conquering of the idea of journalism or any other form of entertainment as a purposeful entity, as one that is just revenue maximizing. So in some ways, this book is really about capitalism in that sense and its triumph. But there are little exceptions. I have a chapter on Oprah Winfrey, for example, who was a really interesting figure in the 1990s, who gains her audience, has had incredible loyalty, is able to direct them to whatever products she wants, and therefore can make a lot more money that way. But she, at some point, decides that she wants to steer everyone in certain directions. And that's very important to her. But she's sort of more the exception. I think the dominant narrative is about a kind of careless, immoral maximization of eyeball revenue at all costs phenomenon and its effect on how we live in our space and that more structural invasion of our lives as opposed to partisanship one way or another. That's what the
but then
big
you see the two sides can come to loggerheads in what we were talking about earlier with Facebook.
Right.
So you've got this sort of amoral, just I just want to get a bunch of money and eyeballs.
Right.
Versus this profound effect on the news.
Right. But the fact is, being partisan is in some ways riskier as a business proposition. And that's one thing. Oprah started
unless
losing.
Unless you're Breitbart or Steve Bannon.
Yeah, they're risky. I mean, they're not.
Successful.
They're pretty successful, but they're not billionaires. No, they have a friend who's a billionaire, but they're, you know, they're not, you know, the repeated lesson is that partisan journalism opinions, when it comes to the real maw of capitalism, are inconvenient. That the in this story, the real true attention merchants only care about ratings, clicks, maximization of audience size, and nothing else. And whatever that takes them, whether it's the counterculture, whether it's left-wing, right-wing, doesn't matter. And that's, I think, the most powerful force in our society, even more than any kind of partisan. And I think it does reflect your idea of Facebook. Facebook didn't care. as long as it got people to click, as long as it attracted eyeballs. That was their final way of seeing about things. And now we're having a debate.
And Les Moonves said the same thing about Donald Trump. Right. You know,
it may be that he ultimately was just catering. It's hard to know. Well, anyway.
Anyway, okay. Well, thank you so much for a great conversation. Thanks for coming out tonight.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.